pleasure to be here. My first time at the Naval Academy, although I'm happy to report that my father did serve in the Navy, so just after World War II. So honored to be with you and honored to be speaking on a favorite topic of mine, the Catholic vision of J.R.R. Tolkien's The Lord of the Rings. So slide, please. The Lord of the Rings is, of course, a fundamentally religious and Catholic work. So writes J.R.R. Tolkien in a letter to a Jesuit priest. Though very few Lord of the Rings fans are aware of this or that Tolkien himself was a devout Catholic. In another letter, he adds that he intended The Lord of the Rings to be consonant with Christian thought and belief, and that The Lord of the Rings is about God and his sole right to divine honor. What could Tolkien have meant by these remarks, especially since the term God, nor certainly Catholic, nowhere appear in the story? These remarks, in fact, have befuddled many scholars over the years. What is specifically Catholic about The Lord of the Rings? While not at all obvious, and while all beneath the surface, the entire Catholic worldview, I would argue, is present in The Lord of the Rings. All these central elements of Catholic doctrine are found there. God and the Trinity are there. Christ is there. The Eucharist and all the sacraments are there. The Church is there. The Virgin Mary and the saints are there. The Catholic view of the human person is there, along with all essential elements of Catholic moral doctrine: sin, grace, divine providence, natural law, virtue, both natural and theological. The Catholic view of the last things, the eschaton, is there, and so much of the Bible is there. Have you all read The Lord of the Rings? How many of you have not read it? How many of you have not seen the movies? Okay, so those of you that haven't seen the movies or read it, I'm sorry, spoiler alert, I'm going to be giving away the story. I'm sorry, but I got to talk about the story, you know, so, I hope that it doesn't spoil it for you, and I do encourage you, please read it when you get a chance. And if you've seen the movies but haven't read it, please read it if you can. There's so much that is not in the movies. To see how the whole Catholic worldview is in The Lord of the Rings, I think one needs really to approach it from the inside. That is, from the inside of the faith. I think it's for this reason that most scholars haven't figured out what Tolkien means by calling The Lord of the Rings a fundamentally Catholic work. I don't have time to flesh all this out. Indeed, really all I can do is scratch the surface. I have a former student here, Deacon Justin Goh. He's a deacon of the Archdiocese of Baltimore, and he can vouch that there's a lot more where this came from. Justin took my Tolkien course. The theme of the course is what's Catholic about The Lord of the Rings. So I'm pulling out just a few common threads that link the whole story together. Okay? What I like to call some of the more salient structural themes that undergird The Lord of the Rings. Before I explore some of these with you, though, some provisos. First, the expressly Christian or Catholic dimension of these themes might not have been consciously so on Tolkien's part. That is not how a Catholic imagination always works. And that's really what I think we're talking about here, is a Catholic imagination. Namely, by conscious interpolation, not so much is it happening. Tolkien's imagination was formed by many factors. Early 20th century rural England, Norse mythology, especially the Finnish tale Kalevala, and Germanic languages, specifically, as he says, Welsh, Finnish, and the remnants of 4th century Gothic. His experience of the trenches of World War I, and so on. But at the top of the list of what formed his imagination, I would argue, is his Catholic faith. Sometimes he might consciously draw upon his faith, but oftentimes elements of the faith probably came out in ways that he wasn't necessarily aware. Biblical imagery is present all throughout The Lord of the Rings, if for no other reason than that Tolkien's mind was so saturated with biblical images, personages, events, that they inevitably colored and helped shape many of the images, personages, and events that he created. The biblical notion of kingship, for instance, was so stamped on Tolkien's mind and imagination that he couldn't but bear traces of it. He couldn't but have it in mind, both consciously and subconsciously, when creating the kingship of Aragorn or the stewardship of Lord Denethor. There are all kinds of parallels between Lord Denethor and King Saul, the first king of Israel, as recounted in the first book of Samuel, for instance. Second, Tolkien expressed an avowed dislike for allegory, preferring instead what he called applicability or, quote, real history. He disliked allegory because he thought it gave the author too much power and control to impose the meaning of the story upon the reader. And consider how inordinate power and control is at the heart of the story of The Lord of the Rings. Applicability, on the other hand, gave more freedom to the reader to see multivalent layers of meaning that are applicable to things that the author maybe did or did not necessarily intend or have in mind, such as applicability to the Bible. So when identifying the Catholic elements of The Lord of the Rings, we must be careful to speak of echoes, resonances, parallels, resemblances, rather than of intentional allegories or symbolism. The Lord of the Rings is not the Chronicles of Narnia, where Aslan the Lion, of course, is an allegory for Christ. Tolkien and C.S. Lewis may have been good friends. In one letter, Tolkien acknowledges that The Lord of the Rings would never have been brought to a conclusion without Lewis's, quote, sheer encouragement. And Lewis's death in 1963 impacted Tolkien, quote, like an axe blow near the roots, end quote. But they disagreed strongly on the nature of myth-making, what today we call fantasy or science fiction. Tolkien called it fairy stories. And you can find Tolkien's philosophy of myth-making or science fiction in an essay that he wrote called On Fairy Stories, which I'd highly encourage you to read if you ever get a chance. Slide, please. At the end of this essay, very illuminating essay, Tolkien makes clear that he thinks all the great stories of Western literature, the great myths or fairy stories, think Homer, think Virgil, for instance, insofar as they contain good and true elements, are but echoes, shadows, of what he considers the supreme fairy story, which is the Christian story. Slide. This story is supreme and it is true, he writes. That is, the Christian story is the supreme fairy story because it belongs not in what he calls the secondary world of make-believe, but in the, quote, primary world of man's history. From this perspective, then, any fairy story that contains anything true and good, as in Virgil or Homer, could be considered a, quote, fundamentally Catholic work. Slide. Legend and history have met and fused, Tolkien asserts at the very end of this essay. The Evangelium, that is, the Christian gospel, has not abrogated legends, it has hallowed them, especially the happy ending. In other words, God, knowing what echoes in the heart of man, what the human spirit yearns for and honors, such as we see in the classics of Western literature, God makes all of this come true in the way that only God can. And we find this story recounted, of course, in the Bible. So should we be surprised that he considers his own fairy story of The Lord of the Rings as an echo of the Christian story along with all the other stories, especially since by his own admission, slide please, he infused The Lord of the Rings with, quote, most of the things he has most loved or hated, and that the Catholic faith, quote, nourished him and taught him all the little that he knew. So with these provisos out of the way, let us move to considering what is Catholic in The Lord of the Rings. And here let me suggest that the Catholic vision of The Lord of the Rings can be appreciated both at the meta level and on the, if you will, the down on the ground or the micro level. So this talk is going to remain for the most part on the meta level, though concrete examples will be offered to put flesh and bones on what I'll be suggesting. So at the furthest meta level, say if we've zoomed out at the level of the International Space Station looking down on the Earth, What we find in The Lord of the Rings is a presentation of good and evil, of beauty and ugliness, of nobility and indecency or wickedness, of excellence of character, especially moral excellence, and corruption of character, that is clearly born of and shaped by a Christian, that is, Catholic worldview. Slide, please. Tolkien's vision of beauty, truth, goodness, nobility, virtue, heroism, it's a Catholic one. As a Christian, for instance, Tolkien knows what virtuous and good character, seen most especially in the saints, looks like. And so he presents to us numerous models of heroism who are paragons of virtue, of moral excellence, paragons of nobility, of bearing hardship, especially for others, of courage, of self-sacrificial love, of high purpose, of beauty, of self-possession, of measured self-control, and prudential action. Consider the list of candidates. Slide. Aragorn, Frodo, Sam, Gandalf, Legolas, Faramir, Theoden, Éomer, Galadriel, Éowyn, and the list goes on. In this connection, one thing I like to ask my students at the conclusion of The Lord of the Rings is to pick their favorite character. The choices are always varied, but they're always from this list. And if we find ourselves drawn to so many of these great and noble characters, it is because, as Tolkien well knows, we are at bottom drawn to goodness, beauty, truth, heroism, and love. Christian faith makes clear we are charged or wired by God for the good, for truth and beauty. And this explains why we are decidedly not drawn to evil and wickedness, to ugliness, to pride, to betrayal, to falsehood, to cowardice, or to hate. Slide, please. For which reason, none of my students ever pick as their favorite character Gollum, or Sauron, or Saruman, or Grishnak the Orc, or Shelob, or the Witch King, or even the tragic figures Denethor or Boromir. Slide. It is telling how, in a letter, Tolkien acknowledged that The Lord of the Rings recounts a story that, quote, can be cast in terms of a good side and a bad side, beauty against ruthless ugliness, tyranny against kingship, moderated freedom with consent against compulsion. On this issue of ruthless ugliness and tyranny, we should note that, as a Christian, Tolkien knows that evil is real, that it exists, and that there are wicked spirits, demons, seeking our destruction. There is such a thing as malice and revenge, Gandalf says to Frodo in the Fellowship of the Ring. Indeed, there is. And the biblical witness makes clear that we find it in all free, that is, rational and moral creatures, both pure spirits, angels, and incarnate spirits, human beings. Tolkien believes in evil. He believes in the devil. That is, he believes in both human malice and fallen angelic malice. And we should not be surprised to find something of the like in The Lord of the Rings. On then to various structural themes of The Lord of the Rings that I think flow from a thoroughly Catholic imagination. So, slide, please. The first, the Eucharist as a structural theme. In a letter to his son, Tolkien says this about the Eucharist. Slide. There in the Eucharist, you will find romance, glory, honor, fidelity, and the true way of all your loves upon earth. Isn't that great? Later, slide, he confesses how he fell in love with the Blessed Sacrament from the beginning, and by the mercy of God, never have fallen out again. Slide. And he counseled his son Christopher, upon being called up in the Royal Air Force to serve in the Second World War, to, quote, know by heart the canon of the Mass, as this would allow him to say this in your heart if ever hard circumstances should keep you from hearing Mass. We shouldn't be surprised, then, to see echoes or likenesses of the Eucharist all throughout The Lord of the Rings. We see this most obviously in the case of Lembas, the elven waybread, which is, slide, more strengthening than any food made by men. That's what the elves say in the Fellowship of the Ring. Okay. Slide, please. The Eucharist, of course, is our way bread. Viaticum, you know that title for the Eucharist? It's the name for the Eucharist when it's given to a person on his or her deathbed, Viaticum. It literally means way bread, or way with. So the Eucharist is our way bread while we are wayfarers in this life. Slide. In a letter, Tolkien affirms that Lembas has a religious significance. Above and beyond its relatively unimportant ability to give endurance of long marches with little provision, and that, quote, no analysis in any laboratory would discover chemical properties of Lembas that made it superior to other cakes of wholemeal. For any informed Catholic, this language of power beyond chemical analysis, it is clear code for the Catholic doctrine of transubstantiation, since the chemical analysis of the Eucharist would also show it to be identical to bread. This is because the chemical analysis is only measuring what we call in theology the accidents or the properties of the Eucharist. The substance of the Eucharist, Christ's body and blood, is beyond sense observation. Slide. But we also see Eucharistic-like resonance in the table fellowship that is omnipresent in the story, particularly pronounced in those meals that satisfy deep longing because following upon intense combat with evil. And the deep longing that these meals satisfy is not simply that born of physical need for sustenance, but deeper social, that is rational or spiritual need for the pleasure, the enjoyment, and the fellowship provided by meals. Animals only eat. They don't have meals. Only rational animals have meals. Meals bespeak our humanity at its most basic and at its most elevated levels. And it is this deeper human need for meals, the need for the satisfaction of human needs at multiple levels amidst a life of suffering and hardship, that the Eucharist meets. For my flesh is food indeed, and my blood is drink indeed. John 6:55. Slide. So this Eucharistic-like resonance in the meals of the Lord of the Rings table fellowship, it begins with a, quote, generous supper provided by Farmer Maggot and his wife of good food, a mighty dish of mushrooms and bacon, besides much other solid farmhouse fare, good drink, beer in plenty, and good conversation and fellowship as Frodo, Sam, and Pippin make their way to Bree while being pursued by the Black Riders. Slide. It continues next with a wonderful meal at the house of Tom Bombadil, a long and merry meal, after being rescued from Old Man Willow in the Old Forest. Slide. Then, while the hobbits make their way to Rivendell with Strider and discover that they are running low on food, it is Strider who tells the hobbits to, quote, think with hope of the tables of Elrond's house. Slide. And so this runs all the way through the story. And don't forget the stew that Sam made with the rabbits that Gollum had procured in the Two Towers, ending with a festal banquet of great rejoicing and merriment after Frodo and Sam's rescue from Mount Doom. What Tolkien is showcasing here, allow me to suggest, is more than simply a Eucharistic sensibility, but a fuller Catholic incarnational or sacramental sensibility. Such a sensibility embraces and enjoys to the full the simplest and most ordinary of earthly goods, whether food, drink, a hot bath, a comfortable bed to sleep in, or even pipeweed, to choose examples from throughout the Lord of the Rings, since in a sacramental lens on the world, these can occasion encounters with no one less than God himself. A sacramental imagination, particularly one that finds in the sacramental meal of the Eucharist, romance, glory, honor, fidelity, and the true way of all one's loves upon earth, to quote that letter again from Tolkien, might well account for the importance of meals and table fellowship in the Lord of the Rings. Slide. Second structural theme, that of elevated or exalted womanhood. Tolkien presents us in the Lord of the Rings with several female figures. Think, for instance, of Lady Goldberry, Lady Galadriel, Lady Arwen, Lady Eowyn, who are among the very wise and powerful of Middle-earth, and who stand toe-to-toe with their male counterparts, yet without losing their feminine identity. If we can speak of a feminism in Tolkien, we must be quick to distinguish it from secular feminism that would overspread Western culture half a century after the writing of The Lord of the Rings. A feminism that turns equality into sameness, and thus where there are no real differences between men and women. Tolkien's feminism, if we can call it that, is more akin to Pope John Paul II, St. John Paul II's feminism, that he spoke of in his apostolic letter on the dignity of women, Mulieris Dignitatem. In Tolkien's world, women, if fundamentally equal to men, remain no less women, complementary to men in biology, in disposition, and in social function. What accounts for his sense of elevated womanhood? Well, certainly, first and foremost, we can look to the fact that Tolkien enjoyed the presence of strong and loving women in his own life. Slide. First, his mother, a gifted lady of great beauty and wit who suffered persecution of her Catholic faith. She was a convert. He says of her in a letter to his son. And then there was, of course, his wife, Edith Bratt. But more remotely, his sense of elevated womanhood is accounted for by his Catholic faith, which holds up countless women as models of spiritual heroism and excellence. Slide. There is Mary and Martha of Bethany and Mary Magdalene of the New Testament. And then, to choose only a few examples, Catherine of Siena, Prater of the Papacy and Doctor of the Church, Teresa of Avila, visionary and great reformer of the Carmelite Order and also Doctor of the Church, Thérèse of Lisieux, popular saint in the 20th century and Doctor of the Church as well. And then there's also Joan of Arc. Slide. Can we not see an obvious parallel between Lady Eowyn, Shield Maiden of Rohan, and Joan of Arc? Slide. But most especially, of course, there is the Virgin Mary. Nothing has captured the Catholic imagination more than the beauty, the holiness, the power, the womanhood, the grace, the nobility of the Mother of God. Tolkien says that to the Virgin Mary he owes, quote, all my own small perception of beauty, both in majesty and simplicity, end quote. Slide. As regards Lady Galadriel, Tolkien affirms that Catholic devotion to Mary is at the source of her character, particularly as described, quote, through the words of Gimli and Sam. Slide. And if we return to Lady Eowyn, beyond seeing a connection between her and Joan of Arc, do we not also see a parallel between her in her confrontation with the Witch King and the Virgin Mary, who crushes the head of the serpent? Slide. A third structural theme, friendship. Recall that according to Christian faith, human salvation is accomplished by means of friendship. No longer do I call you servants, but I have called you friends, says Jesus at the Last Supper, right after saying, greater love has no man than this, that a man lay down his life for his friends. In this connection, consider the crucial role that friendship plays in the Lord of the Rings story, the friendship among the hobbits. It would be well to trust rather to their friendship, says Gandalf to Elrond of Merry and Pippin's desire to go on the quest just after the Council of Elrond. The friendship among the Fellowship of the Nine, the friendship between Gimli and Legolas, the friendship between Aragorn and Gandalf, and most especially the friendship between Frodo and Sam. But the particular form of friendship that I'd like to focus on, because it acts as a thread throughout the whole story, is what St. Thomas Aquinas, following the biblical witness, especially Genesis, calls highest friendship, maxima amicitia, marriage. Slide. Tolkien has an extremely high estimation of marriage, an elevated view of marriage, one that is very strong in biblical resonance and deeply attractive for its power, romance, and beauty. Tolkien threads various marital relationships, either they're already married or they're clearly ordered to marriage, throughout the story, and in each instance we are drawn to them for their beauty, their romantic quality, their power of complementarity, where husband and wife are clearly equal yet distinct. Slide. First, there's Tom Bombadil and Lady Goldberry. Recall that Tom calls Lady Goldberry his, quote, pretty lady. And he dotes on her by picking lilies for her. He wakes her by singing under her window. And we're given a beautiful domestic image of the two of them preparing and serving supper for the hobbits as if, quote, weaving a single dance. What marriage can't relate to the experience of distinct roles working in harmony toward the common good of the family unit at mealtime than weaving a single dance? Slide. Then there's Lord Celeborn and Lady Galadriel Lothlorien. And there's, of course, Aragorn and Arwen. Recall Aragorn and Arwen, these two recapitulate the love of Beren and Lúthien, who are themselves modeled after Tolkien and his wife, Edith. And they suffer through great trial and tribulation in the proving of their deep love. In a letter, Tolkien confirms that, quote, the highest love story in The Lord of the Rings is that of Aragorn and Arwen, Elrond's daughter. Slide. Then there's Faramir and Eowyn. This love story, which is showcased near the end of the story, is a beautiful and tender one. With its multiple garden references, its nobility and near royalty of language and courtesy, its bone of my bones and flesh of my flesh like longing in what Faramir expresses for Eowyn, and for the fact that they are both starting their lives anew, this tale offers clear echoes of our first parents, of prelapsarian Adam and Eve in the garden, presented as Lord and Lady, King and Queen of Eden. This is, in fact, true as well of Tom Bombadil and Lady Goldberry, of Lord Celeborn and Lady Galadriel, of Aragorn and Arwen, and likewise of Beren and Lúthien. Slide. And let's not forget that The Lord of the Rings closes like the Bible does, with the image of marriage and family. There's the wedding supper of the Lamb and the adorning of the heavenly Jerusalem as the bride of Christ at the end of the book of Revelation. And then in The Lord of the Rings, we have, of course, the wedding of Aragorn and Arwen and Sam's returning home to Rosie and his family in the case of The Lord of the Rings. The very last words of The Lord of the Rings, the closing words, Sam says, I'm back. What is he back to? He's back to home. The home of his wife and daughter. Now, some, you know, criticize Tolkien for putting marriage on a pedestal as a naive and romantic ideal that has little to do with the hard realities of married life. Even though, well, there's the whole Ents story. You know how the Ents, they lost their Ent wives? You know that? You know, because they grew apart. They stopped spending time with each other. Important lesson there. That aside, we could retort. Is it Tolkien who puts marriage on an idealistic pedestal? Or is it our culture, dominated by what Pope Benedict XVI once called a new philosophy of sexuality, that gets marriage so wrong and so badly, and so cheapens marriage and sells it short of the heights to which it can attain? Tolkien, we should point out, considered marriage as marking one of the devil's favorite targets. He says that in a letter. Catholic moral teaching, basing itself on the biblical witness, leaves little doubt. Marriage marks a bone of my bones, flesh of my flesh reality that God intends all married couples, along with the happiness and beauty that accompany it, to experience. We would do well, then, to heed and seek to imbibe in our own marriages Tolkien's high estimation of the romantic beauty and nobility of marriage. Slide. A fourth structural theme would be what we could call anti-Pelagianism. And by it, Tolkien shows that he is a true spiritual master, that is, a master of the spiritual life. So Pelagianism, this is the heresy. Have any of you heard of this? It's a heresy that holds that we can overcome evil on our own and resist it by our own willpower, that we can be virtuous and holy by our own power and might, that we can save ourselves. Catholic doctrine considers this a heresy, since our fallen condition means, at bottom, that we are in truth powerless over evil and sin, and that we stand in need of help to overcome sin, especially within ourselves. At the heart of this teaching is, of course, the doctrine of original sin, whereby it is understood that human nature is fundamentally disordered, out of whack, or off kilter, that we are our own worst enemies and that this is traceable to our first parents. Tolkien, for his part, was keenly attuned to this aspect of Catholic teaching, as it was deeply formative of his understanding of good and evil, a divine grace, free will, and the like. Slide. One finds a pronounced Augustinian or anti-Pelagian strain in his letters. St. Augustine was the great opponent of Pelagianism. And that this Augustinian anti-Pelagian strain that you find in his letters, you see it whereby he continually lays stress on the fallen world in which we live. So in one letter, for instance, he writes, "The power of evil in the world is not finally resistible by incarnate creatures, however good." Not surprisingly, then, we find a pronounced anti-Pelagian spirit running throughout the Lord of the Rings, I would say, both in the inability of good incarnate creatures to resist evil on their own and in the corresponding necessity of divine grace to conquer evil. Grace is that unmerited assistance given by God that breaks in and when things look bleakest to dispel the power of darkness and evil. In this connection, Tolkien confirms in private correspondence that grace does indeed appear in mythological forms in The Lord of the Rings. Slide. One simple example of such a mythical form of grace, and which occurs early on in the story, I would suggest, is when Frodo and the hobbits are imprisoned and caught hopelessly by the Barrow-wights, in the Down of the Barrow-wights. That's the language of the text. Prisoned and caught hopelessly. Like us who call upon God or the saints for help, Frodo has the presence of mind to call upon Tom Bombadil. And then the text says this. "There was a loud, rumbling sound, as of stone rolling and falling, and suddenly light streamed in, real light, the plain light of day." Just juxtapose the account of the resurrection in Matthew's gospel, for instance, alongside this text to see the biblical resonance in this passage. Slide. The representative mouthpiece, or the archetype of Pelagianism in the story, I would submit, is Boromir, who, not coincidentally, is qualified as, quote, tall and proud when he's introduced into the story at the Council of Elrond. It's at the council that Boromir says of the ring, quote, "Why should we not think that the great ring has come into our hands to serve us in this very hour of need? Wielding it, the free lords of the free may surely defeat the enemy. Let the ring be your weapon if it has such power as you say." Now, of course, the Lord of the Rings makes little sense if the ring itself doesn't have a much deeper significance whereby it represents evil and sin as disordered attachments to created goods, in this case, the disordered attachment to power. Slide. Very early on, Gandalf observes how the ring takes possession of the one who has it, and he tells Bilbo that it has taken far too much hold on Boromir, which indeed is what happens to Frodo, as it happened to Gollum. Hence the Pelagian folly of Boromir's desire to wield the ring to defeat the enemy, a folly that reaches its zenith in his final confrontation with Frodo. Slide. Boromir betrays Pelagian-like pride when he says, "We of Minas Tirith have been staunch through long years of trial, and we desire only strength to defend ourselves, strength and a just cause. It is mad not to use the ring, to use the power of the enemy against him." And we know what follows. This anti-Pelagian undercurrent that runs throughout the story reaches its apogee in what I would call, slide, the great anti-Pelagian scene in all of Western literature. It's Frodo's inability to arrive at the crack of Mount Doom without external help, without Sam's help, followed by his inability to cast the ring into the fire of Mount Doom and the ring's destruction via outside help. Slide. "I do not choose now to do what I came to do," Frodo says at the very crack of Mount Doom. "I will not do this deed. The ring is mine." Slide. Then, after the ring's destruction, Frodo says to Sam, Do you remember Gandalf's words? Even Gollum may have something yet to do. But for him, Sam, I could not have destroyed the ring. Slide. In addressing the Frodo's failure to throw the ring into the fire in private correspondence, he got pushback on this from fans. Tolkien writes, "It is possible for the good, even saintly, to be subjected to a power of evil which is too great for them to overcome in themselves." In support, he cites 1 Corinthians 10:12. "Let anyone who thinks that he stands take heed lest he fall." And he expressly calls Gollum's intervention a grace. Gollum's betrayal was a grace, since it came at a precise juncture when the final evil deed was the most beneficial thing anyone could have done for Frodo. End quote. Slide. A fifth structural theme is that of gospel-like pity, mercy, forgiveness. In a letter, Tolkien confesses, quote, "The exercise of pity, mercy, and forgiveness of injury underpinned the logic of the story, a logic that was determined, and get this highly significant remark, by the writer of the story, by which I do not mean myself," notice writer's capital W, "that one ever-present person who is never absent and never named." Slide. Elsewhere, he confesses that while penning The Lord of the Rings, he felt, quote, "throughout that I was not inventing, but reporting." I love that. I mean, he's claiming something analogous to Scripture. I mean, because, after all, the human authors of the Bible were moved by God. They were moved by that one ever-present person. Slide. And the model for the exercise of the forgiveness, of course, of forgiveness, is Jesus himself on the cross. Particularly when Tolkien himself observes, Jesus says, "Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do." Tolkien said, this is the key. You want to understand the story? He says this. There's the key. Who embodies this pity, this mercy, and forgiveness? Bilbo? Gandalf? Sam? Frodo? Slide. Towards the beginning of The Lord of the Rings, in a conversation between Gandalf and Frodo, Frodo exclaims that it was, quote, "a pity that Bilbo did not stab that vile creature Gollum when he had a chance." To this, Gandalf famously replies, "Pity? It was pity that stayed his hand, pity and mercy. My heart tells me that Gollum has some part to play yet, for good or ill, before the end. And when that comes, the pity of Bilbo may rule the fate of many, yours not least." As we know, Frodo will eventually show the same pity toward Gollum. But before we get to Frodo, there's Sam. Sam also shows the same pity before Mount Doom. And really, in some respects, it's more remarkable given Sam's suspicion of and hostility towards Gollum. Slide. Let's read the passage concerning Sam. "Sam's hand wavered. His mind was hot with wrath and the memory of evil. It would be just to slay this treacherous, murderous creature, just and many times deserved. And also it seemed the only safe thing to do. But deep in his heart, there was something that restrained him. He could not strike this thing lying in the dust, forlorn, ruinous, utterly wretched. He himself, though only for a little while, had borne the ring, and now dimly he guessed the agony of Gollum's shriveled mind and body, enslaved to that ring, unable to find peace or relief ever in life again." Deep in his heart, what else could this be but pity, mercy, forgiveness? Slide. And it is difficult not to hear echoing in Sam's having experienced the agony that comes with bearing the ring, this well-known passage from the letter to the Hebrews. "For we have not a high priest who is unable to sympathize with our weaknesses, but one who in every respect has been tempted as we are, yet without sin." Slide. Then, of course, there is Frodo's Christ-like forgiveness of Gollum. Recall the key line uttered by Frodo to Sam as Mount Doom is exploding. But for Gollum, Sam, I could not have destroyed the ring. The quest would have been in vain, even at the bitter end. So let us forgive him. So let us forgive him. Slide. It is because Frodo forgives Gollum that Frodo is, quote, extravagantly generous. Tolkien, that's the language of Tolkien. That he's extravagantly generous toward Gollum, that Middle Earth can be saved. Slide. A sixth and last structural theme that I'll mention, and perhaps the most important, since the whole story turns on it, is the Pauline notion of folly, the folly of the cross, made famous in 1 Corinthians. Let's read that passage. For the word of the cross is folly to those who are perishing, but to us who are being saved, it is the power of God. For it pleased God through the folly of what we preach to save those who believe. For Jews demand signs and Greeks seek wisdom. But we preach Christ crucified, a stumbling block to Jews and folly to Gentiles. But to those who are called, both Jews and Greeks, Christ, the power of God and the wisdom of God. For the foolishness of God is wiser than men, and the weakness of God is stronger than men. As St. Paul sees it, the cross concerns a folly of salvation accomplished not simply in a completely unforeseen manner, but in a manner that smacks against human wisdom, a manner that, at least at first sight, strikes one as foolish. After all, holding up a dead man on a cross as our Savior seems like pure folly, pure nonsense. Death by crucifixion marks a cursed death, according to Jewish law, and a heinous penal death of the most gruesome, torturous sort, according to Roman law. Imagine holding up someone sitting in an electrocution chair. Electrical chair, you know, being executed to death. Something similar to that. It's the ultimate sign of human weakness, of human limitation, of the human inability to overcome his worst enemy, death, and to be his own savior. And therein lies the key, according to St. Paul, since if we're saved through a death by crucifixion, it can only be by God's power and might, not our own. Thus, St. Paul recognizes a higher wisdom at work in Christ's death, a divine wisdom, even if on a purely human level, it seems like folly. As for the Lord of the Rings, the very quest to destroy the ring is modeled on this Pauline notion of divine folly. Slide, please. We know this because of the very language used by Gandalf in pitching the idea of the quest at the Council of Elrond. It's as if it's straight out of 1 Corinthians, and it's striking when you juxtapose what he says alongside that 1 Corinthians passage. Quote, this is Gandalf. It is wisdom to recognize necessity when all other courses have been weighed, though as folly it may appear to those who cling to false hope. Well, let folly be our cloak, a veil before the eyes of the enemy. Slide. Gandalf repeats this language in the Two Towers after he has reappeared to Aragorn, Legolas, and Gimli in Fangorn Forest. Quote, Sauron supposes that we, the Fellowship, were all going to Minas Tirith, for that is what he himself would have done in our place. And according to his wisdom, it would have been a heavy stroke against his power. That we should try to destroy the ring itself has not yet entered his darkest dream. Wise fool. Wise fool. What a brilliant Pauline play on words. The word folly reoccurs again several times in the remainder of the story, always with this Pauline ring. Most notably in Gandalf's contest with Lord Denethor, and then near the end, when Gandalf counsels a final assault on the Black Gates to draw Sauron's attention away from Mount Doom. Slide. Here, Gandalf says, in the midst of making this pitch, Sauron's eye is now straining towards us, blind almost to all else that is moving. So we must keep it. We have not the ring. In wisdom or great folly, it has been sent away to be destroyed, lest it destroy us. Without it, we cannot be forced. Without it, we cannot defeat force by force. But we must at all costs keep his eye from his true peril. We cannot achieve victory by arms, but by arms we can give the ring bearer his only chance, frail though it be. So that's all I have for you. I've barely scratched the surface. For instance, I have not even mentioned how, for instance, Gandalf is a Christ the prophet-like character, the one who speaks with a higher knowledge and higher wisdom, or how Frodo is a Christ the priest-type figure, the one who shoulders the cross and who offers himself for the salvation of Middle-earth, or how Aragorn is a Christ-like, Christ the king-type figure, the king who has a first coming in obscurity, simplicity, humility, poverty, and a second coming in glory and majesty amidst great fanfare. But I hope I've helped bear out what Tolkien meant when he called The Lord of the Rings a fundamentally Catholic work. Thank you.